Head to Subway for the tangy new Tuscan Chicken Melt. Seasoned chicken, melted cheese, and olive vinaigrette. With 9 grams of fat, it's part of a Subway Fresh Fit meal. A simpler way to enjoy eating better. Hurry in today. Subway. Eat fresh.
The BS Report is a free-flowing conversation that occasionally touches on mature subjects.
First of all,
this is the BS Report with Bill Simmons.
It might be cool, I don't know. And if it's not, I don't care.
The BS Report with Bill Simmons.
Bill Simmons works for ESPN. He's also named the sports guy, and he writes a comical sports column. You must be a popular dude.
The BS Report.
It's got a real dirty sound, like a rusty steak knife cutting through a well-aged steak.
Now.
Here's Bill Simmons.
All right, welcome to the BS Report. Unfortunately, I'm doing this one by phone because I am back on the East Coast where it is pouring rain. And I think we're setting the record for most 50-year-old rich white guys who are being rained on right now at Bethpage. On the phone, and one of my top 35 favorite Cuban American columnists, now it's here in the Subway Fresh Take Hotline, Mr. Dan Le Batard. What's happening?
The phone lines, what's up? I mean, ESPN, sports guy, you know, what? In this modern age, you can't get a phone line that works well?
They sent me this device that can hook up to my phone line and sound fantastic on the podcast, and I forgot to pack it.
That's good work out of you.
Yeah, great job by me. What's going on?
I'm happy, man. I'm good. How about yourself? Are you tortured and neurotic while conquering the world?
Well, I wanted to have you on because you recently gave an interview saying that we were going to host Pardon the Interruption together, which was breaking news, especially to me, since I had no idea we were hosting Pardon the Interruption together. So,
God. And you got legitimately mad about that.
I didn't get legitimately mad. It's just I didn't know where it came from.
You and I have talked about doing Pardon the Interruption. The guys at PTI have asked me about hosting Pardon the Interruption with you. What's the big step from there? We just haven't finalized dates. And first of all, I didn't know you were breaking news.
I have a news flash for you. I might still do PTI, but I'm going to do it with Jason Whitlock.
Okay.
You're out.
Okay, well, now I feel totally betrayed in public, and you waited to undress me publicly, which is so vindictive. It's a betrayal of the highest order.
Actually, I don't know if Whitlock's allowed on ESPN.
Oh, that's true. He's not. So now you just feigned betrayal. Now you're just...
Oh, man. Poor. Can't we bring Whitlock back to the fold? I don't understand why this has to be this way. I think the company the last 2 years has been going in a really good direction, especially creatively. And I think, you know, and granted this is a little selfish because I'm involved in it, but this 30 for 30 documentary series we have coming up is something that this is a case of ESPN using its power in the best possible way. We have money, we're taking the money, we're giving it to really talented filmmakers, and they're going to make documentaries. They're telling their own stories, we're leaving them alone. Their own stories about the last 30 years of sports, we're not counting them down. We're not saying, you know, we have to do Tiger Woods because he was one of the biggest guys. These are just 30 stories, and I think people are going to think this is really cool. And it's not one of those things that we have to hype up because it's just good. You know,
ESPN has done, you know, ESPN has done a lot of the excellent work over the years. But I've thought that HBO Real Sports, for example, has carved out a niche doing some of the stuff that ESPN is capable of doing if it focuses itself. And this will be, you know, the best thing that anybody's ever seen in sports television. This project, you know, I don't know. Is the Kobe doing work part of that?
Because not part of it. Not part of it.
Kobe took too much control over that thing and ended up sabotaging the entire project because he cares so much about his image, and he ended up neutering Spike Lee. But
well, hold on a second though. I wouldn't say that. I wouldn't say that Spike Lee was blameless. I think that was a one-day shoot with a lot of cameras, and you know his initial attempt was just watching Kobe run around. Basically, there wasn't even a director's commentary. So, eventually they convinced him that the Kobe interview needed to be had, but that was a 90-minute interview of Kobe watching the documentary, basically.
But
I just thought it was lazy.
The thing about the project, it may have been that too, but the thing about the 30 for 30 project is I'm guessing that nobody is going to have an image on that project that is going to require, or an ego, that requires as much creative control over what's being done.
Yes.
As that one, it'll just be. It feels, from whatever everything I've heard about it, it feels like it's going to be honest and real. And I don't see how it can't be the best thing ESPN has ever done.
Yeah, and I think, you know, for whatever reason, as you said, HBO carved out that territory. But I thought HBO's gotten lazy. You know, I watched that 1960 U.S. Open documentary, and it was like it came out of the HBO cookie cutter factory. The same narrator, it was done the same way, it had no surprises in it. And it's like they had almost turned this into a formula, and now the door has kind of been opened, I think. And, you know, I think you even saw with the Joe Buck Show on Monday night, so predictable. Every choice that they made was a choice that I would have guessed. You know, they had an elaborate set. They had too many guests. They had some sort of theme. Yeah, we're going to talk about, you know, the celebrity factor of sports, but then why is Brett Favre on? Why is he your first guest? What does he have to do with your theme? It was just, I don't know what was going on with that show. You had Joe Buck on, right?
Yeah, and Showtime, I guess Showtime has probably been the door. There's been some good stuff being done by Showtime because HBO has opened the door on the monopoly. We had Joe Buck on yesterday. I felt bad for him, man. Can you imagine? Because I, you know, I'm no good at television, and I just can't imagine. I would have turned into a puddle of sweat. There only would have been a jacket on the floor because the one thing that was unexpected on the show was Artie Lang, or expected and not expected. I guess it's kind of probably like the steroid stories.
Yeah.
Anytime a steroid story breaks, you're shocked that it's Manny, but you're not surprised at all.
Yeah.
I mean, that's what happened with Artie Lang. And, yeah, I felt really bad for Joe Buck, but his discomfort made for great television and made for, you know, made that. Otherwise, that would have been a show that only sports geeks watched, and that made it something else.
I have a couple of thoughts. Well, first of all, I forgot to mention you host a show on 790 AM in Miami that is very popular, and you have a lot of guests, and we're going to get into that in a second. But so you had Joe Buck on after the train wreck of Monday night. I disagree with you in one respect. You put Artie Lang on live TV, you got to be prepared something might happen. Like, when he made that first joke that I'm not allowed to say about Joe Buck's second favorite website, Joe Buck's reaction was like he was totally blindsided. He didn't know what to do. He, like, kind of had his hand covering his face and was just staring in disbelief. It's like, you're not ready for Artie Lang potentially to come at you. You're not familiar with his work that he's on for 20 hours a week, being able to swear and be profane on this Howard Stern show.
Well, his girls were in the audience. Joe Buck's girls were in the audience. He made me laugh yesterday because I asked him, "What is actually your second favorite website?" And he just blurted, "It ain't that."
Right.
Which made me laugh, but I don't know how. But you're already nervous. Look, he's a polished television veteran, but it's your first show. You're out completely out of your element. This isn't what you've ever done before. There's a great deal of pressure. You're already nervous, so it's just really bad judgment to throw somebody in there who's, you know, a heroin-soaked crazy person.
I just for the record, I like Artie. I don't blame him for doing what he does. That's
wait,
his thing.
Wait a
That's
minute.
His
wait
shtick.
A minute.
You have him on to allegedly push the envelope, and then he pushes the envelope, and you react like, oh, my God, the envelope's been pushed. What do we do? And it's like, well, why'd you have him on?
Heroin-soaked crazy person is something that you objected to? Wouldn't he describe himself as that?
I think that's a little strong. I think he's, you know, he does what he does. Why was he on? Why do you have him on? Why do you have him on a live show? You have Joe Buck, who is really a play-by-play guy, who has no stand-up comedy experience, who has no experience hosting a show like that, who, to my knowledge, has never hosted a talk show or even a podcast, has he?
I don't. Has he ever
interviewed anyone?
I don't know. I think he does the other end of that. I don't know. I mean, I'm sure he's interviewed people after games, but no, they had
the thing
three
is, like, when Artie started going off, it showed exactly why Joe Buck wasn't qualified to host a show like that, because he had no idea what to do.
But who in sports would be is what I'm saying to you. Like,
Bob Costas would have ripped Artie Lang apart. I mean, you're talking about guys who have experience in any kind of talk show situation or hosting situation. I mean, I feel like even you would have kind of known what
to
do.
I don't know. No, I think I would have. I think I would have retreated. I think I don't know what I would have done. I don't even having thought about it afterward, I don't know what I would have done. And Bob Costas, I guess, might have been okay because it would have been one of these, you know, to try to be clever one-upsmanship things. But Bob Costas isn't going to win a fight against a comedian when they're both making fun of each other. Like, you're not qualified to win that fight.
Well, that's why you don't try to do the one-upmanship. You just laugh. You laugh at yourself. And that's why, you know, I look at this Joe Buck thing. It's like I've been watching baseball for 10 years. I don't remember one funny moment that he's had during the Fox play-by-play. And I was just like, really? This is going to be a talk show with comedy? Like, is Joe Buck funny?
Well, he's got some dry wit, but the reason they had him do that is because he's got a little bit of edge grading on the sports curve, a little bit of edge. But that's what happens when a little bit of edge meets real edge.
It's when fake edge meets real edge. And, you know, I just think it was such a dramatic mistake to have Artie on live if you weren't prepared for the consequences. And then to go the other way and be like, Artie's banned from HBO, you know, and try to distance yourself from what happened. And so you had this guy on. I posted a tweet about it. It's like, if HBO is going to have a segment where you have pit bulls playing with little kids, and they're like, look, coming up next, pit bulls playing with little kids. And then one of the pit bulls mauls the kids. You're like, oh, my God, this is horrible.
I don't think it was a mistake, though. I don't think that a lot could have happened better for Joe Buck on his first show. Uncomfortable TV. Like, one of the things we do on our radio show, and I'm not saying that we have the model for anything. We just laugh and enjoy ourselves. But we're anti-radio in that, I just make fun of myself. And if something's uncomfortable, we relish it. If I'm getting embarrassed or being made a fool of, it's sort of part of the spectacle, part of the entertainment. And TV and radio and entertainment takes itself so seriously that
you don't think Joe Buck did that though.
Well, but I'm saying that what ended up happening because of that dynamic, because Artie Lang was walking into the cathedral of sports television and, you know, just urinating all over the place. That's what made it memorable television. That's what made it good for the show, I think. Like, I don't think that was a mistake or a bad thing for the show. It would have been terrible. We asked Joe Buck yesterday, would you do it over again? Because he was really uncomfortable, and he didn't like it, and he got mad. But he's like, would I do it over again given what's happened? Yes. Yeah, I'd do it over again, exactly the way that it played out.
Well, that's ridiculous, because I thought he came off terribly. I thought he came off uptight and humorless.
It doesn't matter if people are – if you're creating a conversation. Like, that, I mean, it was his first show. There was bound to be all sorts of stuff that was going to be bad. But let's do it this way. If Artie Lang doesn't appear on the show, and if that moment doesn't happen, are we talking about it a couple of days later, and does it have any echo whatsoever?
So you're saying that just because something happened made it worth it?
I'm not saying it's fun, but if you're getting people to talk about your show, if you're getting, you know, did you see this uncomfortable thing? If something right now happens on this podcast that is embarrassing to you and I, it's good for your podcast. It's not comfortable. It's not good to be the subject of that.
But Levitard, I'd rather have people remember the podcast because it was good, not because something stupid happened and I needed some sort of gimmick to get people to be interested in it.
But
like, Joe Buck had like 3 months to plan this show. They built a $500,000 set for him. They paid God knows money to do whatever many segments and use the cool cameras and Here's me eating at a restaurant with David Wright and all this stuff. You can't tell me that this was the best case scenario.
I'm not saying it's the best case scenario. I'm saying it's the best case scenario in a bad scenario. And if we're talking about brand name recognition and what your product is doing versus the singular person who is being made uncomfortable in that, let me ask you this.
Yes.
Michael Phelps hung up on our show, on our radio show. I didn't want that to happen. I didn't like that to happen. I was uncomfortable with it. It made me feel bad. I felt bad for Michael Phelps. And he hung up angry and was, you know, calling me names as he hung up, but he didn't hang up correctly, and so you could hear me calling or him calling me names.
Right.
Is that good or bad for my show?
What did you do to make him mad?
I asked him if he ever drops the Wheaties boxes in the nightclub and asks women, how did that get there? The Wheaties boxes with his face on them.
That's kind of funny.
Well, I mean, he wasn't getting it. And I felt bad about that. You know, it just ended up becoming something embarrassing unintentionally. But now it's media gas bag versus, at the time, certainly, beloved American icon. I got no shot at winning that. So I felt uncomfortable. Because I got no shot. That's, you know, Olympic hero versus, you know, media guy. And is it good for my show or isn't it?
Well, you've had a couple of those. You had, didn't Jay Billis hang up on you too?
Yes.
And you also had the Tim Hardaway thing, which I would say was a gift from the radio gods. I mean, granted, that wasn't the greatest incident, and, you know, it certainly killed Tim Hardaway's any sort of chance he had to do anything in the NBA. But at the same time, for your show, I would say that was probably a good thing.
Jay Billis, actually, now that I think about it, didn't hang up on it. We just got into an argument in which he called me really stupid, which is an argument, by the way, that I'd like to – it's a discussion I'd like to have with you, because really what I was getting at is, why are there no great white American players in the NBA?
I heard that. I actually listened to the YouTube clip this morning.
YouTube preparation.
I was doing all my extensive research on Dan Le Batard. It's one of those things you're not supposed to talk about. Why aren't there good white guys anymore? It's like it's a no win. You could probably talk about it because you have the whole Cuban American thing.
But why is it?
I think that gives you more leeway.
But why? I mean, we should be able to talk about it. Like it's obvious. It's obvious to everyone staring that there are guys who are great and white in college, who are great white Americans in college. See, this is the thing about the discussion. I don't understand why you can't discuss it. Because, and then I asked Stan Van Gundy the question, and his response is, well, this is why there are great white Americans in college who don't translate to the pros, and the Europeans,
yeah,
it's not the same, because if you're 6'10", 6'11", in Europe, you're going to be trained on the outside, you're going to be given a versatile game, you're going to end up being someone who looks like Peja Stojakovic or Dirk Nowitzki. If you're in America and you come through our pipeline, we're just going to stick you in the post, whether you're qualified for it or not. That seemed to be an interesting way to have the discussion without stepping on any of the landmines, and, you know, it was a white guy having it.
First of all, I love talking about race, and it's one of my favorite things. I'm saying, like, if it was me, I would love to talk about it. And I think, you know, in my opinion, the reason would be that basketball has just become so emphasized now in athleticism that, I don't know, it just seems like the athletes that they're getting in the NBA are gearing toward one specific type of player, not the Tyler Hansbrough type. It's more like the Tariq Evans type.
Well, the reason we were discussing is because I was wondering whether, and you've read Blank and you're a fan of Malcolm Gladwell, I was wondering,
yeah,
if in the assessments of Blake Griffin and Tyler Hansbrough, at the time I guess it was Michael Beasley and Tyler Hansbrough,
yeah,
that their resumes look very similar, and you know, but they look differently in a number of different ways, their game being one of them, but I was wondering whether subconsciously it's possible that if I put Tyler Hansbrough and Blake Griffin in a room or on a basketball court and I let them play for a while, whether embedded subconscious, you know, prejudice would creep in, because you've got a body of work where the white American basketball player doesn't end up being any good in the pros. Like, there's a long body of work, and I know that sports is a meritocracy, but I wonder whether in the scouting of that individual that would creep in at any point.
I think it's creeped in with centers. Is the one thing where, you know, I remember, like, when Spencer Hawes was a prospect 2 years ago, I wasn't that familiar with his work. I didn't see him that many times. And just thought, oh, that guy will suck. He's white. You know, and it's like you don't even think twice. All you're basing that off of is the 25 other white lottery pick centers that have come before him that sucked. You know?
Here's a Clippers question. Is Chris Kaman good? If Chris Kaman were a black guy, given his statistical resume, not that he's played on very many good teams, would,
yes,
he be considered a better player?
I don't know. He's a tough one, because it's hard to imagine him being anything other than the white guy with the crazy hair and doing, you know, I can't imagine him in any other scenario.
The black guy with the crazy hair, though, got 3 or 4 defensive player of the years just because he played at the center of, you know, the longest defense that kept funneling stuff toward him, even though Ben Wallace wasn't any good.
I would say that the one guy that his color seemed to be almost a detriment in a weird way was Kevin Love. Because that was a guy, to me, was a can't miss. And he went 5th, and it seemed like some people thought it was kind of a reach at the time. This is a guy that in college just rebounded. He could shoot threes. He was a great passer. Like, he had skills that immediately translated into the NBA. Like, I would have bet my life that Kevin Love was going to be a good pro.
Did you?
And yet, people were a little down on him because they're like, oh, he runs like a duck. He can't jump. It's like, I don't care. That dude's pulling down 15 rebounds, you know, in the Pac-10 in some games, and he's making 25-footers. That guy's going to be able to play in the pros.
Did you talk to Gladwell about that or about these kinds of things at all? I mean, because, I mean, there is the Pat Cummings stigma. If you look a certain way, it happens,
yeah,
with coaches, too. It happens. I'm convinced that if Stan Van Gundy looked more like Pat Riley, that he would, you know, just the presidential look, appearance, the way it affects things, you know, that Van Gundy would, his, you know, panic would be perceived as passion if, you know, if you look like Bill Cower, if you look like, you know, John Gruden.
Well, isn't Charlie Weiss the best example of that?
That's
the guy who thought, I can't get a head coaching job unless I get gastric bypass surgery because the only reason I'm not getting a job is I'm so fat.
Mm-hmm. Although, I mean, in that sport, I mean, there have been oddly shaped people all the time running it and demanding discipline from others. And like that. But, yeah, that's a good example. I mean, when the guy is – he was administered last rites, wasn't he, during that because that procedure was so dangerous?
Almost died. I like your idea that Van Gundy, if he looked different, because when you think about it, you know, if you use that blink analogy, there are certain coaches that I think it's really helped them how they look. Like, for instance – John Gruden should have been fired 2 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
But it's like, oh, yeah, John Gruden is so intense. Look at him on the sideline. Oh, you know, good with the media. He's gruff. He's getting up at 5:30 every morning. But the results really hadn't been there. And he was kind of on life support with them for 2 years. And everybody was shocked when they got rid of him. It's like, would you have been shocked if he was 360 pounds? Probably not.
And you buy yourself a lot with a championship, too. You buy yourself a lot of room. I think with him, one of the things that was interesting is the whole mythology that we have in sports of the, you know, the dictator boss. We love that guy. The idea and really sometimes the illusion of him running things through fear and respect when, you know, I remember I've talked to, you know, dozens of Dana Stubblefields about the idea of them fearing an arched eyebrow, you know, when they've conquered God knows what to get to the top of sports, culturally, environmentally, you know, and then the cutthroat system, the ecosystem of sports. They've conquered all of that to get where they are. And then you saw it on Monday Night Football when John Gruden started yelling at Keyshawn Johnson, and he yelled back, and John Gruden had to slink away. This is Keyshawn Johnson. It's not, you know, it's not 340-pound defensive tackle guy. That the whole mythologizing of sports leaders, because we want them to be that guy. We want to believe in somebody can coach them up and be smarter than everyone else and lead, you know, the undisciplined through discipline and structure and team to glory.
That's kind of like what Bill Belichick this decade seems to have gained some momentum, not just because of the results, but he's one of those guys that, for whatever reason, whatever he's doing, it seems like the players respect him.
Mm-hmm.
You never see those type of, you know, you never see those type of moments, the people screaming at each other. When's like, have you ever seen Bill Belichick screaming back and forth with a player on the sidelines? It's like never happened. But when we were growing up, or maybe even a little bit earlier, you know, that was, I grew up watching the Celtics and Tommy Heinsohn yelling at everybody. And now I think what happened like right around the mid-70s is that once the athletes started making more than the coaches, that was it. You know what I mean?
Yeah, that changes. It changes when they're boss and employee. But Tony Dungy did it a different way and won as well. I mean,
and Phil Jackson, I think, is another great example of, like, you almost have to go substitute teacher a little bit.
Joe Torre is a good example, too.
Really good example. Now, I mean, he barely even is awake anymore. He just sits there.
Yeah.
Is Joe awake?
Yeah, just gentle. I mean, how would you like it? One of the things that's always fascinated me about sports and sports fans is the idea that, you know, there's so many people out there listening to sports radio and railing against sports who hate their boss,
Yeah.
And yet they want the sports boss to be the boss they hate. They want the sports boss to yell at the millionaires. And there's another way to do it. You can be human. You can be an ally. I mean, Joe Torre, Phil Jackson, Tony Dungy, they're allies, and you can win that way too.
I think that's the way it's going, and I watched it firsthand with my man Rick Pitino when he came in with the Celtics, and this was back in the day when everybody thought college coaches could translate into NBA coaches. They're kind of starting to get away from that now, and he's yelling at everybody. And then Antoine Walker was eligible for a 6-year, $71 million extension, which they signed. They come back from the lockout, and he's yelling at Antoine Walker. And Antoine Walker's like, I don't need to hear this. I'm going to make $71 million over the next 6 years. Go F yourself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That was it.
And that helps create some of that. I always have a hard time untangling the importance of coaches, because you saw a great example with your Celtics team where, I mean, Doc Rivers was a laughing stock. He was about to be fired. And then he became champion when they changed his players. And I just think that usually we give so much attention to the coaches, and I say that usually the difference between the guy on one sideline and the guy on the other is more negligible, a lot more negligible than the differences between, you know, the best players in basketball. I mean, Phil Jackson, everyone would argue that Phil Jackson is a better coach than Doc Rivers, but Doc Rivers kicked his ass because he had three great players and a big front line, and the Lakers, you know, at the time had Gasol and Kobe, and then were a little skittish.
And he also, Rivers also had the best defensive assistant in the league. You're preaching the choir, because I just, as you know, I wrote a 700-page NBA book that almost put me in the hospital. And I spent page after page and word after word talking about players and teams, and maybe 2-3 pages total talking about coaches. And the reason was this. We just have too much evidence that coaches don't really matter, ultimately. That you might have, you know, Phil Jackson matters. Greg Popovich matters. But really, it depends on the match between the coach and the talent on his roster. And if the coach doesn't have the talent, like we saw with Phil Jackson in 2005 and 2006, he's not going to win. If the coach does have the talent, now we're talking about it depends on the talent of the coach, how much he can exact from that roster.
Mm-hmm.
But ultimately, if he's got a really good team, it doesn't matter what he does. I think Stan Van Gundy did a bad job in the playoffs, and the wheels could have come off 5-6 different times. But he had a good team. He had a guy who averaged 15 rebounds a game, and everybody else was shooting 40% from three. You know,
you've come around on the coaches, though. I mean, I didn't think. I mean, when Stan Van Gundy is winning 6 and 7 on the road at Boston, and then beating LeBron, he's got a pretty good team. But he's got an extraordinarily offensively limited player in Dwight Howard. He's got Rashard Lewis is a completely confusing player to me at 6'10" with no ability to handle the ball, playing from the outside, and the Magic at the end were revealed as there was only one guy on the court that you trusted having the ball in his hands, and he was 6'10" and from Turkey. Like that it became at the end of that, like I was like, it didn't feel, you know, Gasol is underrated because he's European and he's not soft. I don't know how he gets called soft. And
so KG kind of punked him out a little last year. He was definitely intimidated by KG.
But he's very good. I mean, like Kevin Garnett is hard to play against. I mean, he wasn't punked out by Dwight Howard, was he?
That's true. You know, when you brought up Rashard Lewis, you made me think of something I had been thinking about the race thing. Rashard Lewis really has the game of a white guy, the stereotypical white guy game. He's an awesome shooter. When he puts the ball on the floor and he's dribbling her to the basket, it's just going to be a mess most of the time. Doesn't really rebound. Like, he's basically what you would think Steve Novak plays like. He's like the best version ever of Steve Novak.
He was frustrating to watch during the playoffs.
Unbelievable. Like, it literally has no idea how to dribble toward the basket and make a 12-footer. But yet, for, you know, in the right kind of circumstances, deadly.
It's just confusing to me how guys I guess maybe they're just sculpting a singular skill to the detriment of other skills. But that team, it wasn't just Rashard. It's Dwight Howard. What is he doing offensively? How can you be that good on one side of the court? And I know we've seen it a number of times. And he would be completely unstoppable. You could park a bicycle on that guy's shoulders. He's the biggest man, and he can't do anything around the basket except dunk.
No coaching. Came right out of high school. I think he's got a fairly low basketball IQ, I got to say. I was talking about this at my buddy's house after the finals. We were talking about how disappointed we were with Dwight Howard, and we were like, are we sure this guy has, like, any basketball sense? Like, I'm not just talking about how he blocks shots out of bounds, but, you know, it just seems like something's not clicking for him. Is that you got DJ Mbenga on you? You should be scoring on DJ Mbenga. Like, you're blocking a shot in a key point of the game, you should be tipping it to your teammate. You shouldn't be getting your fourth foul in the beginning of the third quarter because you bumped Derek Fisher as he's trying to dribble up court. Like, these are just dumb basketball plays.
It's weird to me. I mean, if Shaquille O'Neal were a foot taller, would he or would he not be the worst thing to have ever stepped on a basketball court? You know, a foot shorter, excuse me. And with Dwight Howard, it's just raw. It's an unbelievably raw game. I don't know how much of that has to do with basketball IQ and how much of it has to do with, I mean, if he developed just, you remember, Shaq started hogging the titles the moment that he, you know, developed a little turnaround bank shot.
He also got really, he got in great shape that one season.
Mm-hmm.
And then the next two title seasons played himself into shape as the season went along. But for whatever reason, that one year when he just blew everyone away, he was in awesome shape. I always thought the game just came too easy to him, too early, and really wasn't that much fun for him to play. You know, he's like, he's the biggest guy. He gets called differently than any other center. He gets hacked. He gets his shoulders pulled. He gets knocked around. When he scores, he gets no credit because he should score because he's Shaquille O'Neal. And I just think after a while, he's like, this is kind of a no-win for me. You know, so I'm just going to show up. I'll show up for the season. I'll play myself into shape. I'm going to make $20 million a year. I'm going to have fun. I'm going to party. And that's my career.
I'm going to enjoy my life. It's looking increasingly now. I mean, it's taken us a while to connect the dots on this, but it's looking increasingly like down here, like it, the Stan Van Gundy Pat Riley thing wasn't Pat Riley's doing. It was Shaquille O'Neal did not want Stan Van Gundy barking at his ass to work harder to be less lazy, and he didn't want it, and so he went to Pat Riley, and I'm here because of you. This I haven't gotten this confirmed anywhere, but it's a lot of people around the organization thinking it and saying it. Just the idea that Shaquille O'Neal went and told Pat Riley, I'm not playing for him, and then they had to do what they did, because what choice did they have at that point? They can't come out and say, hey, Shaq doesn't want to play for Stan. It's Shaq's fault.
Do the people of Miami, do they still consider that a legitimate title? Or what? How do they feel about that now? Is it like they're just like, oh, yeah, that time we stole the title? Or is it like, yeah, that time we won the title?
They're mad at you for consistently urinating on their title.
It was terrible. It was a terrible, terrible, terrible finals, and just so tainted in so many ways. And then to compound it, the worst title defense in the history of sports other than the two Florida Marlin defenses.
I'll grant you that the basketball defense was unbelievably weak. It's still hard to believe that team ended up winning that title because Shaq didn't even do much in the final.
And the stats are so crazy. Like, I think Dwayne Wade shot like 91 free throws in six games. And the next highest number was something like ever in finals history, the next highest number is something like 71. He had 20 more free throws than anybody ever in the history of the finals.
Outside of the Pistons beating the Lakers, I was having a hard time remembering the last time that you could get away with winning a championship with just two, you know, just really one. You had a finals where both teams had one great player playing great, and that's not – You don't have that anymore. You can't win a title that way. I mean, you need Ginobili, Parker, and Duncan, and now you need Gasol and Kobe. Like, to have one guy on your side that's really playing great, that doesn't win a title very often anymore.
Yeah, and I wrote about this for the website this week. Like, it drove me crazy the way that the media handled this Kobe thing as the finals was going on, when really the main reason they were winning the title wasn't because of the way he was playing or any sort of changes he had made in his game, but the way Trevor Ariza was playing, the way Gasol was playing, the way Odom was playing. He was getting a lot of help, and those guys enabled him to win the title, and we never heard about them. The Trevor Ariza thing was incredible. This was a guy that people were like, they can't win because this guy's not ready. And he comes in, and he does maybe one of the best sidekick jobs I think we've ever seen in the finals.
That was a great column you wrote for those. I mean, people should go read that, because
the Lakers fans didn't think so.
I think we do a lot of revisionist history when the scoreboard changes. I mean, Allen Iverson. I remember Allen Iverson never changed during his career. He was always the guy who was showing up at walk around practices smelling a little bit like liquor. But the year that he made it to finals, we turned him into a changed man when the only thing that had happened was the scoreboard changed. And
yeah,
you showed statistically. There's no argument. You showed statistically that Kobe was exactly the same player during these playoffs as he was during the last playoffs. But we just shaped the discussion around him to fit the storyline.
Seriously, though, what is in it for everybody to perpetuate the storyline that Kobe is a leader and he's so different and all this stuff? Like, why is that interesting? Why did I feel like it was almost like this pathological need by a lot of these media people to keep pushing it and to keep telling me, this Kobe Bryant, he's great. He's so good. You don't realize how good he is. It's like, I kind of do. I've been watching him for 12 years. I think I do realize how good he is, actually. I don't need your help anymore.
Aren't those nicer things to believe in, though? I mean, one of the things
For what purpose, though?
They just feel nicer. Like, this is one of the things that consistently gets me called a contrarian in my writing, because I minimize the importance of the intangibles in sports, the things that people want to believe in. They don't want to hear from a sports agnostic that, you know, that it's not heart, clutch, you know, that it's not that one team wanted it more, that those aren't good explanations for what it is that you just witnessed. And
right.
And we want to believe in, oh, it's nicer. We don't want to believe the selfish guy can win. Like, who wants to believe that? You don't. Who wants Terrell Owens to win a championship? There are going to be a lot of people happy for Terrell Owens if he wins a championship, so we'd rather believe that the selfishness gets in the way of his winning a championship, or Barry Bonds, who was, you know, won LeVon Hernandez performance from winning a championship, that the selfishness and being a jerk was a detriment, and it's easier to believe in, well, Kobe changed. He's nicer. He's more of a leader. He passes more. He got his teammates involved. He changed. I mean, it's intellectually lazy.
Well, and also with Barry Bonds, that's a great point. So if their bullpen doesn't collapse in Game 6 of the 2002 World Series, I forget which, that was 2002, and Barry Bonds wins the World Series, is he a selfish?
Well, he can say eat it. Like, he's still viewed that way, but he...
See, I feel like they would have been the revisionist history of, see, Barry Bonds isn't a bad guy.
Do you really think we would have even done it with him, you think, huh?
What?
You really think we would have even done it with him?
I it was happening in that World Series. They were talking about, oh, Barry's much easier to be around. Yeah, Barry's much more committed to the sense of the team. It's all horse crap. It's like, first of all, if you think that all of our superstars in the sports world are good dudes, then you got another thing coming. I hate to break it to you, but I'd say it's about 50-50, maybe even less.
Well, most people, though, are selfish. Like, I mean, nobody cares about my interest the way that I care about my interest. And so if I work for, like, some of the principles in sports are interesting, and the things that we want to believe in, and harmony and unity and those things, like, they're interesting, because if you and I worked on a sales force and the company was doing really well, we wouldn't be okay with the company doing really well and us not doing really well.
Yeah.
And it's the same thing in sports. The idea that you expect, you know, some guys, Edgerrin James and Anquan Boldin, while they're making a Super Bowl run, to be okay with, you know, not being the reason for winning. We had an interesting conversation one time on the radio with Steve Smith of the Carolina Panthers, where we were pressing him. You know, he was using, like, the winning is everything, winning is the only thing that matters. And so we asked him, okay, what would you rather have? 12 catches and 160 yards and a loss, or one catch for 6 yards and a win? And the answer, of course, was 12 catches. I mean, Michael Irvin during the Super Bowl was yelling while Alvin Harper ran with his touchdown ball. Like, that pass was supposed to be to me, and Alvin Harper is running for a touchdown, and Michael Irvin, they don't want to just win. They want to be the reason for winning.
I was flying back to Boston before Game 6 of the 2008 Finals, between Game 5 and Game 6, and happened to be in a plane with Ray Allen's dad and some other family member. I couldn't figure out if it was like a cousin or an uncle or whatever. And I was wearing like a Celtics shirt, you know, because I got to represent on my cross-country flights.
You're a
jerk. And he's wearing the Ray Allen jersey, and we at some point we just kind of looked at each other and we started talking. And Ray Allen's dad was so mad that Ray Allen wasn't getting more credit for what was going on with the finals. He didn't even care about who was winning. He was like, my son better win the finals MVP. That's all I can tell you. He's been the best player in this team, and he's going to get screwed out of the finals MVP because Doc Rivers wants him to get screwed. And that's why he's not going to win, because Doc Rivers keeps pushing Paul Pierce. I'm like, are you kidding me? Your son's about to win the NBA title. But, that's just the way it is. I mean, when we start guest hosting PTI – let's say our ratings are better than Wilbon and Kornheiser. Do you think Kornheiser, the most neurotic guy on the planet, is going to be like, oh, this is great, I'm glad the ratings are up when they're on?
Please tell me that during the hosting of PTI that you will summon the impersonation of Ray Allen's dad again for the listening masses.
I made him sound like Fred Sanford. I don't know why.
You please do that again. Please do. Can we do?
That's what he sounded like. What do you want from me?
Can you do LeBron James' dad? Just do LeBron James' dad after the Orlando.
Well, I don't. Have we ever heard from LeBron James' dad?
No, but I just want you to do LeBron James' dad.
All right, you're only trying to get me in trouble now. Wait a second. Let's talk about your weird writing sabbatical. Actually, I shouldn't call it weird because it happened for reasons. But I compared you to David Carradine walking the earth like Kung Fu for a year on your radio show. And now David Carradine has apparently been hung in either a murder or an auto asphyxiation accident or whatever that happened. Do you think that's a little eerie?
My sabbatical ended the same way, oddly enough.
So what happened? You got burned out.
It involved ninjas. What happened was I wanted to spend more time with my family because I was working five jobs and none of the jobs feel like work and I love doing all of them my girlfriend's sister died and left us, a two-year-old child, and it was pretty traumatic, and I just wanted to spend more time just with family members and not be, I miss so many weddings, and we love this thing we do. I got to imagine that you've had some of the same stuff where you just miss some stuff because of your need to write, these epic columns. And I can't even imagine what the book did to you. I can't imagine what the book did to your life, if you found structure or if you were able to find balance where you were just writing sometimes without sort of always obsessive compulsively racing on thoughts and things that should be in the book. But I was just, there was a lot of stuff I missed, and there was a lot of stuff that I was there for but wasn't really there for because I was preoccupied with something else. And so I just wanted to detox for a year, and it was really nice. I mean, it was really eye-opening and blissful. Spent a lot of time with my parents. It was just good. It was nice.
I've only had that happen to me once. It was the summer of 2001. I'd had my old website for 4 years, and I was killing myself on it, and then ESPN finally hired me for a column. I had 5 weeks off. 5 weeks off of nothing, doing nothing, just going. And I went to a wedding that first weekend, my buddy Bish's wedding. And I was, drunk the whole weekend. Drunk not in a good way, not in a cool way, but, why is he drunk the whole weekend? And it took me almost, 4 weeks to come down and just kind of be like, yeah, all right, I'm a normal person again. But I know exactly what you mean. It is nice to get away from it. At this point, I don't know if I could do it. I'm, so conditioned to coming up with stuff and thinking about stuff. And I feel like if I stopped for, 3 months or something, I feel like my whole world would collapse.
Well, it's also
kind of sad, right?
Well, no, it's addictive to make people laugh, to entertain people, to get your ego fed by,
I'm not talking about that. I think it's like golf. It's you got to keep going out there and keep swinging. For me, I'm not, obviously that's not the case for you, but for me, it's I'd be afraid that I wouldn't be able to remember how to hit a 9-iron anymore.
But you don't think that if all of a sudden you weren't being validated, every time you write something, every time you do something, it gets you an avalanche of pats on the back. It gets you an avalanche of validation.
No, you know why though? Because when I was in college and I had a column that was popular and, every time I wrote something, they walking around, hey, great column today. And then when I graduated and I didn't have a column for 5 years, and I just never got used to not having a column.
Mm-hmm.
But eventually I did get used to it. So I feel like if it went away tomorrow, I'd be fine with it because I was, eventually got used to it before.
But if all of it went away, if you couldn't write, if you couldn't be heard, because before I went on the loftily called sabbatical, which was really just a vacation, but Kornheiser told me, because I was thinking about leaving everything, the radio show.
Yeah.
Kornheiser said, do not leave everything cold turkey. You will be walking around your house talking to the plants.
yeah.
And it was good advice.
Yeah. Well, you really like doing your show. You're really happy when you do your radio show, it sounds like.
Yeah, I mean, we spend a lot of time laughing. I mean, I don't know if it's good, but it certainly entertains us, and some people enjoy, the contagiousness of the laughter. But I'm just working with my friends. It's all I'm doing. All I'm doing there is working for and with my friends. And so it's, it's just a little bit of a frat house.
Yeah, but it seems like you got burned out on the whole writing process, though.
Well, writing hurts. It's still more rewarding than anything I do. It's more fulfilling when I'm done. But I don't know how you feel about exercise, but for me, it's like exercise. I don't enjoy doing it. I enjoy the results. There's some people who enjoy doing it.
I still enjoy doing it, and I think maybe what happened to you a little bit is it seems like there's two ways you can go. You can either say, all right, I'm as good at this as I'm ever going to be, and then you have to either say, am I cool with that? Or is there still a little places I can, like, what else can I do? Or you can go the way, I'm as good as I'm ever going to be. What do I do now? And I think that's what happened to Kornheiser. And he, in fact, he's talked about it. He was like, he hit a point where he's like, I can't get any better. What do I do? And it destroyed him. He didn't want to write anymore.
There was something else that happened with Tony, too. Like, I had a long conversation with him about, you know, the death of newspapers and the nobility of writing and the idea of yodeling on television and doing all these silly things on radio and television to, you know, for the cotton candy vanities. I was going to a dark place with the conversation. I'm like, how does that make you feel? And his response was, rich. The fact that he's made a lot of money doing it, writing doesn't pay the same way that the other things do either. So
that's interesting. I do. So maybe it was a combination of both for him. But you're talking about Kornheiser. First of all, in the late 70s, early 80s, one of the single best takeout feature guys of that whole generation, and then became one of the three or four best columnists. You know, not just of his generation, but he's in the all-time discussion, in my opinion, for sports columnists. And at some point, just hit a wall, and that was it.
And television and the work ethic at ESPN and the pulling in different directions, like that. If writing is hard, and it's hard, and it takes work and it takes effort to do well, and you have a lot of other things pulling away from you. And I had an interesting conversation years ago with Matthew Kelleher, who works behind the scenes at Pardon the Interruption. I don't know how many people you've worked with in television, but the group over there is as smart as anybody I've ever met.
Yeah.
And Kelleher was telling me, and I realized then the way that sensibilities were changing. He's a really smart dude, and I had just written something about Edgerrin James, a big takeout that I thought was fascinating about how he grew up, you know, working on. He never worked out when he was young. He just got really muscular by 14 because he worked on a watermelon truck, carrying watermelons and hiding his money from crackheads that he still hangs out with, who spot him when he goes back to work out at 2 o'clock in the morning in Immokalee, which is one of the most impoverished places in the country. And I thought it was interesting, the story, and his eyes sort of glossed over and was like, I'm not reading. People today aren't reading the big takeout anymore. So the thing that Kornheiser was doing, the thing that Kornheiser got so much fulfillment out of, was becoming less and less relevant as we move into 140 character Twitters. And so you either fight that and lose, you either fight it and lose, or you go and you give in and you try and entertain yourself and enjoy the rest of your life.
Yeah, that makes sense.
That's heavy-handed, though, huh?
I know. I feel like I want to have a cigarette and pour a scotch and put on a smoking jacket and think about what just happened.
Isn't that something you would do if we had like a rhythmic moment like Holly Hunt and William Hurt in broadcast news, where it feels like, you know, good sex? Like, that didn't feel like good sex. That felt like very aggressive. Very, very. I would
just stop.
good idea.
I got to say something though about, you left out one part about doing TV and radio versus doing the writing thing. When you write, you're by yourself. It's all you. It's just you. You start out, you open your computer, you look at the screen and it's empty, and then you fill the screen with words and you hope that it comes out okay. You're doing a show like PTI, you're doing your radio show every day. You're with people all the time. You're making each other laugh. You're having a good time. You're like, what are we going to talk about? This is great. And I think that's where it gets seductive. Because I know, just like when I worked on Jimmy's show, and it was only 18 months, and I left because I just missed my column, and I just felt like I had to make a choice, and I wasn't ready to give up the column yet. But that 18 months that I spent working on that show, I remember more fondly than any writing stretch of my whole life, because I loved hanging out with everybody and making each other laugh and coming up with the process of creating stuff, and it was just so much better than writing in every respect.
That's a hell of a point. Yeah, it's less lonely. I would argue, and not to probe too psychologically here, but not even, what do you think about the idea that the Jimmy Kimmel experience is absolutely something that you would have kept doing if you were Jimmy Kimmel versus working in his army? Like, now you are, in your world, doing what you do, you are Jimmy Kimmel. You have others helping you be good at what you do. So I
do? Who's helping me?
You don't have others helping you with podcasts and...
Oh, yeah. But, I mean, ultimately, it's I'm the one, you know, the onus is on me. I think I would love to be in a situation where I had a writing staff. I think that would be fantastic. I guess you could argue that, like, you know, if I have a writing staff, I guess it would be the readers. Because I think, you know, my mailbag's my favorite column to write. And I get so many good emails, and it just, I wouldn't be able to do that column as well if it wasn't for them. But, you know, when you know, like, for instance, Riley hosted PTI, and we're both friends with Eric Rydholm, who is the producer of PTI and, you know, is a genius. But he said when Riley came on, he had the same reaction that everybody else has when they host, is, oh, my God, that was so much fun. I can't believe how fast it went. That was the greatest day I've ever had. And they're just, like, giddy.
Uh-huh.
And that, so when he, you know, when Ryan was trying to get me to do it, he's like, you don't understand. Everybody who's ever hosted this show is one of the five greatest experiences they've had of the year. And I don't know, it does sound addictive.
It's a lot of fun. My first experiences there were a little scarier because I didn't know what I was doing. I don't have any television training.
Yeah.
The show is big and smart, and those two guys are better at it than anyone, and I respect them immensely. So I was a little nervous, and I'm paired with Max Kellerman, who is, no joke, wandering around the offices, and I love Max Kellerman, wandering around the offices. I didn't know him at the time, telling everyone who will listen how great it's going to be because he's the best public orator since Martin Luther King. And I'm looking around. I mean, the guys at PTI still make fun of me because of how scared I looked. I'm like, is this going to be, you know... just the end of my career in a heap of embarrassment because neither one of us has done this. One of us is confident and the other one isn't.
I actually saw that show, and right as it was ending, you made a Albert Brooks sweating broadcast news joke, which I appreciated. And I remember thinking, like, I feel bad for that guy. Like, he just seemed like he didn't enjoy that much. And now you've done like 300.
Because of them, what they've built around that show is amazing. So that, yes, they absolutely make it fun. And it sounds like you've been convinced. It sounds like you are now breaking news on your podcast.
No. Here's my issue. I have no doubt that I'd be confident and maybe even decent, maybe even good by like the 12th time or the 14th time or whatever. The first few times I'm not going to be good. I'm just not, because nobody is. It's one of those shows. It's like doing anything else. It's like having sex for the first time. It's like driving a car for the first time. Like, there's so much going on that you're just not going to be a natural at it. I've never seen anybody go into PTI and ace it the first time.
No, it's impossible. But why not embrace that, though? See, this is what we were talking about before with Joe Buck Live. Why not embrace that there's going to be a backlash, that you're not going to be very perfect, that, hell, they've built an entire persona for me on that show with the understanding that nobody who replaces Tony and Mike is ever going to be loved because... they're Tony and Mike. They're familiar. They're great. They've got an unbelievable chemistry together. They've been friends for 30 years.
All right, here's the deal. I'll do it. I'll do it this summer. But the first day, you have to dress like Tony Montana and Scarface.
All right.
You have to wear a white suit.
Okay, that's a deal.
You have to wear the white suit. Which white suit? What scene was that? Are you Scarface from Really
High? Of course, but I don't. I mean, wasn't it the wedding that he was dressed in?
Yeah, I want some sort of a suit that, and maybe we'll have a tiger.
We'll bring the
maybe
tiger.
Maybe at the end of the show, we'll go look at the tiger like they did after the wedding. I forgot to ask you this because we got to go soon.
The Scarface hold up, because I've watched it recently and it's awful.
It's pretty bad. But I mean, couldn't you say that about any 80s movie, though?
I don't know. What I mean, Major League holds up, doesn't it?
That's 1989, though. If you go pre-85, it's going to be bad. I love St. Elmo's Fire. I own it on DVD. It's bad. Scarface is bad. Like, I watched the Blues Brothers recently, and not good.
Animal House
really
holds up?
Good.
Animal House holds up?
for some reason, Animal House has seen, I mean, these movies have scenes that hold up, but they're so slow.
Caddyshack? And Caddyshack hold up?
Caddyshack's one of the few.
Stripes?
It does hold up. Stripes does not hold up. It's got good scenes, but, you know, the one that holds up the best and I feel like could be released right now and actually is more cutting edge than it was at the time because the language and just how racist Nick Nolte was 48 Hours.
You can't, yeah, that's a good one.
Flex. It's actually more effective now because at the time it's like, yeah, this guy's being mean to Eddie Murphy and then they're going to be friends. And now it's like, this guy's been horrible to Eddie Murphy. Look at these words he's using. Oh, my God.
Well, isn't All in the Family the most racist show that's ever been?
Well, 48 Hours has that scene. And I really hope they don't bleep this because I'm just saying what happens in the scene. But after Nick Nolte is just horrible to Eddie Murphy for like an hour and 50 minutes, and Eddie Murphy, whatever, they get split up, and Eddie Murphy calls him, and he comes down to the bar to meet him. And Nick Nolte's like, thanks for calling. And then he says, I'm going to say N-word instead of what he actually said. He's like, N-word, watermelon, I didn't mean that stuff. I just do my job keeping you down. And Eddie Murphy goes, well, doing your job doesn't explain everything, Jack. And he's like, I guess you're right. Eddie Murphy does the Eddie Murphy cackle. Like, can you imagine having that scene in 2009? I was just doing my job keeping you down. What?
You've
racially defamed me.
I would like to hear that conversation between your fake Nick Nolte and Ray Allen's dad. Can you do that for me?
I can't do the Ray Allen's dad. I'll do Fred Sanford instead of Ray Allen. Elizabeth, I'm coming to join you. hold on, though. Top five Miami movies, and then I'm letting you go.
Do you realize how terrifying it is that you know how much of that scene that you know back and forth, each of the cadences and syllables of that?
Wait
scene?
A second. You don't understand. I could do 48 Hours cold. I could do the entire movie.
Okay.
I am talking. I've seen that movie 300 times. I can do every single scene of dialogue from that movie.
Where does
how
it
sad rank? Is that?
What happened to Eddie Murphy? I mean, what happened? Eddie Murphy is one of the greatest things to ever happen in entertainment in our lifetime. What
and to me, top five greatest things ever happened to me.
and what
he's
happened?
He's the first cool person I ever knew.
What happened there, though?
Too much too soon, kind of like you. He's wandering the earth like David Carradine, like you were. I just think it was too much. He was the most famous. I guess Richard Pryor. Well, top three most famous black entertainers by the time he was 20.
Ah, but he did. He was still doing great work in his 30s, though, wasn't he? Like he was still doing. Man, I just like him a lot. I'm trying to think of what.
I've thought about this a lot. Believe me, because he's my. You know, when I was growing up, it was Larry Bird, Eddie Murphy, Sonny Crockett, David Letterman, Bruce Springsteen. That was my big five. Eddie by 88 had kind of. What happened to him happens to a lot of these guys is that they're really funny. Part of the reason they're really funny is because they're around people all the time, and they're picking up stuff like, oh, yeah, that writer's assistant, he does this. I'll work that into something. But by 1988, he had made like $200 million or whatever, and he lived in this giant mansion in Bubble Hill, and he was surrounded by three family members and two friends who did everything for him. He wasn't around people anymore. So how do you continue to be funny when you're not around anybody?
That's it's interesting too when you sculpt a singular skill. Like I'm working on a story with Bernie Kosar down here, just about Brett Favre's difficulties, and he was so insulated for so long, concentrating on football that just recently he's started doing things around the house. And his girlfriend walked in the other day because he knew so little about working around the house, doesn't know how to start the coffee machine, doesn't know how to start the dishwasher, doesn't know how to iron shirts or start the washing machine. She walked into the kitchen, and he was he didn't know how to cut the French bread, and there was a saw in the kitchen. A saw.
Wow.
Like when you're that kind of insulated, because everyone's doing stuff for you and you had live-in maids and maids assistants and everything, like, yeah, it's hard for it not to change the way your life is experienced.
Eddie coming to America was his last great moment. Boomerang, a half-decent comeback, but I think at that point the wheels had come off and that was it. But, all right, well, we'll get to the top Miami movies next time.
Okay, we'll do that next time. Did you like the A&E or the biography thing on Eddie Murphy? Because I love him. And
I do, too.
And did you see that, the biography, like the Sports Century Eddie Murphy thing?
It's Sports Century for Eddie Murphy?
Well, I mean, it's, you know, it's the A&E biography, the equivalent.
I have not seen it, and I would love, wasn't it like 2 hours? I've been dying to see it.
It was great.
When we do the Miami movies, I'd like to throw Bad Boys in as as one of the secret underrated gems of not just a decent movie, but like a nice blend of the movie and the city. But we'll get to that next time.
They just filmed Burn Notice in front of my apartment here. A couple of days ago, there was a car falling three stories out of the sky. Before you go, are you going to get me some damn Twitter followers? You've made me a 40-year-old adult begging for help from somebody who's powerful. I feel pathetic doing it. Are you going to do it for me, or are
you
not?
I'll do it when I post the link for today's podcast. I will post the nice link for your Twitter site, and then everybody can jump on the Levitard Show bandwagon.
It builds a good community, man. They help you, just like your listeners, just like your, I mean, I think it's silly and narcissistic and dumb and a product of how it is America's gotten dumb, but you can build a good community with it that helps you with stuff like your readers do with your mailbag.
Yeah, I think it's changed from, hey, I just came back from the gym, to actually people using it as an effective form of both marketing, communications, staying in touch with people. I think it's going in a good direction, not a bad one. And I was the biggest anti-Twitter guy, but I think it has too many good things about it to just dismiss it, in my opinion.
How do you like how Shaq's using it?
Self-serving, but yeah, I mean, that's another example of how to use Twitter. Like, he's using it in a self-serving way and trying to stay in the limelight, and he's always kind of lingering over everything, you know?
It's interesting. I find it interesting the way that athletes need the media less and less, you know, that they don't.
Well, that Kevin Love thing. Kevin Love breaking the Kevin McHale story on Twitter.
That's accidentally funny.
All right, so 790, what is it, 790theticket.com?
790theticket.com.
PTI, and I will see you this summer. You have to wear a Tony Montana suit at least one of the days.
But you're doing it. You're confirming it. We are doing part of the
interruption. I'm not confirming anything. It's up to Eric Rideholm. But if the schedules work out and Wilbon, you know, or whoever, they can't, then whatever. We'll do it.
Do the Ray Allen dad.
Yeah, I'll think about the Ray Allen dad.
See you later.
Dan Levitard, thank you.
Thank you for downloading the BS Report with Bill Simmons.
Too much fun.
Check out more podcasts at the iTunes Music Store or at PodCenter at ESPNRadio.com.
Peace out.
That concludes, ends, finishes, wraps up another BS Report. With all the talk about baseball, the upcoming football season, and hockey playoffs, Bill Simmons neglected to mention something which frankly cannot go unstated. Okay? Here goes. For a limited time, hurry into Subway and enjoy the new Tuscan Chicken Melt. Lovely seasoned chicken, melted bubbly cheese with olive vinaigrette, piled so high with the crisp veggies you love on your choice of freshly baked bread. All that deliciousness with 9 grams of fat. It's part of a fresh fit meal.